You're listening to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This is a special rebroadcast of a previous episode. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Getting quality health care can be hard enough for everyday people, but for the more than 49,000 people in Illinois prisons, that process can be even tougher. 2 years ago, a team of court-approved researchers went to 8 prisons across the state and reported widespread problems that included major backlogs and delays in treatment. The ACLU of Illinois has since sued the Department of Corrections on behalf of several inmates, saying that standards of medical care at state prisons is so poor that it's unconstitutional, and the results could force the Department of Corrections to overhaul care at dozens of facilities. In a few minutes, we're going to be talking with one of ACLU's staff attorneys, but first, joining us on the line now to share his story is someone who's experienced this firsthand, Roosevelt Burrell. Roosevelt, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
I appreciate you being willing to share your story with us, Roosevelt. I know you were incarcerated from 1987 to 2011. During that time, what kind of sicknesses and injuries happen to you? Did you suffer from?
Well, actually, there was numerous, numerous, like so many other who are presently incarcerated. Mines were from headaches to accidentally being sprayed in the face with a mace or CS spray to dislocation, shoulder dislocation, kidney problems, you name it,
And when you had something, for example, like kidney problems, what was the process like trying to get treatment? Did you have to fill out a form? Did you talk to someone?
The first thing that you would do, you would fill out a form. You could talk to or try to talk to someone since it's of urgency. But unfortunately, no one would actually hear you, and they would tell you, to file a sick call slip. And the sick call slip would take anywhere from forever, it's supposed to take a matter of days, for them to see you, but...
And when you say forever, then how long would it take? Would it take weeks?
Well, sometimes they, they're lost in the mail, most of the time.
So you have to put it in the mail? If you would like to
yes.
request, you have to mail something to someone saying, I need medical help.
Yes, you would mail it to the department, to an external part of the facility, and they're supposed to get it, they're supposed to receive it, which sometimes they never do, as I said. And so many times, this lead to people putting in more slips to try to address the an issue, which sometimes never go addressed.
I'm speaking to Roosevelt Burrell. We're talking about his experience receiving health care while he was incarcerated. We're talking about this because of an ACLU lawsuit on behalf of several inmates to the Illinois Department of Corrections. We did reach out to the Department of Corrections. They responded as saying that, quote, outside of court filings, the department has nothing to add about health care in its facilities, end quote. Although state lawyers have argued that the inmates in the ACL lawsuit indeed have gotten adequate care, and I want to bring someone else into this conversation. In studio with us here at the Middle Newsrooms in downtown Chicago is Lindsay Miller. She's a staff attorney with the ACLU of Illinois. Lindsay, thanks for being here with me.
Thank you for having me.
As you're listening to Roosevelt's story, is that fairly typical? Is that the process that if inmates even now, so that was back in 2011, inmates have to put in, like you have to send something through the mail if you need health care?
Inmates do have to submit a sick call slip, and often it's through institutional mail. And the process that Roosevelt is describing is very typical of what we've heard. The entire system is disorganized. There's chaos, and with maintaining documents and things get lost. I'm not surprised to hear that this was his experience at all.
And Roosevelt, how many requests did you say that you would have ended up sending over your period of incarceration? Do you even know?
Over my period of incarceration, I don't have an idea.
Wow.
Because, and like I said, I had a few injuries.
And when you didn't hear anything, what kind of things did you do on your own to try to feel better?
Well, one thing I would do would be to try to meditate, to try to escape the pain, you know. So pain is common among a lot of people, you know, a lot of the people that's incarcerated, you know what I mean, because there's very little that or anything that they would do anyway, you know, to help you. You know, for instance, I had a dislocated shoulder while incarcerated, and the first thing that I was told to do was, after a long period of time, I mean, this
one. Did you mean weeks or months? Did you say six months?
This was 6 months. This was from August, probably longer. This was from August of 2005 until April, I believe, April of 2006. And so I could not sleep at all. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't.
And could
get
you
any
have
rest.
Roosevelt? Did you get? Are you able to get things like Tylenol or pain medication? How were things? Were those things available to you when you were incarcerated?
The magic bullet that they use in prison is ibuprofen. They give
okay,
ibuprofen
and that and you
everything.
Were at that at least you had ibuprofen. It sounds like
that was after what? After probably. Three to four months.
Of asking for it?
Yes.
So it took 3 to 4 months for you to get ibuprofen?
Yes.
Wow. So just to be clear, Roosevelt, you're not involved in this specific lawsuit, Lindsay, that the ACLU has filed. Lindsay, can you tell us about some of the experiences involved with those clients involved with medical care? Is it similar to what Roosevelt is sharing with us?
It's absolutely very similar. And the delays in care and treatment that Roosevelt is talking about are exactly the sorts of things our clients have experienced. And needing to find other ways to kind of alleviate pain that clients have to do for themselves because the department isn't being responsive. We have one client who not too long ago had a very severe tooth infection and was told that it needed to be extracted. And after weeks of waiting, because of backlogs, this extraction couldn't get scheduled, so the client had to remove his own tooth.
And this is, I imagine, why you're saying that medical care doesn't meet constitutional standards. Can you explain that a little bit? What in particular is, I mean, I think from a logical standpoint, it sounds like, yes, if someone has to remove their own tooth, that doesn't seem like that meets kind of a constitutional standard. But legally, what does that mean?
Yeah. And you know, there are many ways to describe it. And I think common sense is probably the best way to think about it. Prison officials are required to provide adequate care to those in their custody. And Illinois just has not met that standard, as Roosevelt is indicating, for a long time. So if you're hearing about a delay and it sounds excessive in your personal life, chances are it's not meeting constitutional standards. We have another client who has torn nearly all of the ligaments in her knee and has been told by an outside doctor that she requires a total knee replacement, and that was 5 years ago, and she hasn't received this procedure. And the department has only been able to provide things like ibuprofen or physical therapy, which at her stage, it's not going to be helpful. So when you're hearing about delays this long and treatment this minimal, you can be sure that it's not meeting constitutional standards.
And can you give us a sense, Lindsay, of how widespread this problem is within the prison system in Illinois? How many people are facing healthcare problems? Certainly, we haven't even begun to talk about substance abuse all this week as we've been later on in the hour. We are going to be going back to our week-long series we're doing about on opioid and opioid addiction. Certainly, we've always heard that the prison system is in some ways the largest substance abuse provider or counselor in the state. But just I wonder if we're even apart from just maybe substance abuse issues, if we can talk about health care in general, health and mental care in general. Can you give us a sense of how many people are needing care within our prison system?
Sure. Well, it's broadly accepted that prisoners on the whole across the nation have greater health care needs than the general population. I think some recent numbers have said prisoners on average, about 50% of them have suffer from at least one chronic illness. Compared to the general population, it's closer to 30%. Illinois in particular also has a very rapidly aging population of prisoners. We're in the top 10 nationwide of prisoners over the age of 55. And understandably, the older you get, the more likely you are to have serious health needs. Illinois is also we over-incarcerate in Illinois. The prison system was originally designed to hold 32,000 inmates, and currently we're around 44,000, and in very recent years we're up near 50,000. So the healthcare demands on the system are quite substantial.
Roosevelt, was your experience when you were incarcerated that this, what Lindsay's saying, were there lots of other inmates alongside you that also had chronic health problems?
I mean, it was common, you know, to hear of someone, you know, with some very serious, you know, issues that they were facing. You know, me myself, I believe that when we while we were in Tams, I was in Tams Close Supermax during this time, and there were so many guys, there were so many prisoners who were in pain, you know, constantly around you, that it was almost normal, you know, to hear someone, you know, complaining about trying to get some type of relief, trying to get to the doctor's office who was, you know, really a joke and you know, to many of us, because he was he never did anything for anyone. You know, you would go to the doctor's office and say that.
It would be a process, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. After a long period of time, when they saw me, the first thing he wanted to do was, you know, I tell him that my shoulder, you know, my shoulder was dislocated. I told him how it happened, and he wanted to look at my scrotum. You know, I mean, what is the relationship between the two? You know, you want to look at my foot, or you want to look at, you know, an area that's unrelated, you know, and I'm telling you that I'm in this great amount of pain. I'm in such pain that I can't, you know, bear it.
Can I ask you one last question, Roosevelt? You now have been out of prison. You served your time. You have been out for 6 years. Has your health gotten better since then?
Well, unfortunately not. You know, along with the numerous issues that I had coming from the prison system, I was, not long ago, I was in a car wreck, so
I'm sorry to hear that.
I'm battling some things from that too, but you know, so I'm still, you know, going through my shoulder, different shoulder pains. My kidneys now have from prison, my kidneys have multiple cysts, you know, build up around them, and that's another thing that while I was in prison, I turned orange after a while, which caused my family, you know, to, when they came to see me, they stopped coming to see me because they couldn't bear to see me in the condition that I was in. So this was a thing for a lot of people in prison that went through the same thing, you know, that their family would come and see them, you know, suffering the way that we were suffering, and they would stop. A lot of them couldn't take it. So,
Well, Roosevelt, thank you. I appreciate you sharing a little bit of our story. Lindsay, we just have about a minute or so before the break, but the class action suit that the ACLU has would force the Department of Corrections to change its medical care system at many of its facilities. I wonder if just before the break, I know you probably won't have time to answer all of it, but what kind of changes do you think need to be made?
So, we want them, they need to make changes on a broad scale. And I think the way to think about it is to start from the top down. The department needs to invest in strong, stable leadership, in training their professionals, in making sure that these professionals can provide clinical guidance and oversight so that it continues over time, that it's not just a Band-Aid, that you're really investing in having quality professionals performing this work. Vacancies need to be filled with the backlogs that we've talked about, the delays in care. These vacancies have existed in facilities for a very long time. There needs to be a priority in filling those. And there needs to be significant effort put forward in rewriting policies that are outdated, that don't meet current standards of care, such as with chronic clinic care and infirmary care. These are kind of the first steps in creating a long-lasting plan that's going to show you change over time.
I want to thank Roosevelt Burrell for joining us. Roosevelt, thanks for taking the time to share your story. I appreciate it.
Thank you as well. And I appreciate the good work that Lindsay is doing, and I applaud you. Keep up the good work.
Thanks for that.
Thank
yeah,
you.
We're going to continue our conversation with Lindsay in just a minute. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. Stay tuned to hear more of this encore edition of the show. Coming up, we'll have more stories and news from across Illinois. This is an encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for tuning in. We've been talking about healthcare in Illinois' prison system. My guest is a staff attorney with the ACLU of Illinois, Lindsay Miller. The ACLU has actually sued the Department of Corrections on behalf of several inmates, saying that standards of medical care at state prisons are so poor that they're unconstitutional. We're talking about whether the results could force the Department of Corrections to overhaul care at dozens of facilities. Again, a note to our audience, we invited the Department of Corrections to join this conversation. They declined and basically said outside of court filings, they have nothing to add about health care in their facilities. Lindsay, before the break, you were just talking about sort of systemic changes that need to be made. In particular, you mentioned vacancies. Can you elaborate that on a little bit more in terms of what vacancies need to be filled?
Sure. There are 26 facilities throughout IDOC, and for a medical team, there are three primary leadership vacancies: a medical director, a healthcare unit administrator, and director of nursing. And these are the fundamental positions for any healthcare system. They keep the system going. And as you mentioned earlier, there were experts that were appointed in our case to visit several facilities and do an investigation and report back on their findings. And several facilities were lacking these key critical leadership positions. Notably, at the time when the experts visited, Dixon Correctional Center, which has a really special mission within the system. It houses most of the older inmates throughout the system.
Right, because you mentioned the population is also aging.
Correct.
When we say aging, what do you mean? Do you mean 70s, 80s?
55 and older.
Okay.
Is kind of how we define the geriatric population. And Dixon has kind of a special role there where it houses most of them. And Dixon happened to not have any of those leadership positions filled. And that's something that we see happening throughout the system. You know, positions, they come and go. There's a high turnover. And there really needs to be some stability in those positions if any system is going to improve.
You also mentioned rewriting policies. What do you mean by that? What needs to be rewritten specifically?
Sure. So one example is policies related to the care of those with chronic illnesses. The experts found that there was kind of a cookie cutter model to these policies where people with chronic illnesses were scheduled to be seen three times a year, regardless of how well their diseases were being controlled. And the expert recommended that this needs to be changed. People should be evaluated and their future appointments should be based upon how well they're doing at that time. If, you know, they're deteriorating, then they need to be seen more frequently. So this is just a kind of backwards way of treating chronic illnesses. Another policy that needs to be developed is infirmary care. We've seen instances where prisons don't know the line of when an inmate can be treated in an infirmary versus needing to be sent to the hospital. In one instance, there was an inmate who was sent to the infirmary who was experiencing progressive paralysis throughout his lower body, and it was happening very rapidly. And they kept the inmate in the infirmary for 2 weeks before sending them to the hospital. And at this point, this inmate's permanently wheelchair-bound. So policies really need to be developed to say, okay, once we're seeing certain signs that we cannot control in this setting, we need to get these inmates to a hospital where they can receive the proper care.
What's next with this lawsuit?
Right. So now we do have a class certified. So we represent all inmates throughout the entire system that have serious medical and dental care needs. And we will be pushing this case aggressively towards trial. We think that we need relief for our clients, and we want to get a system in place, and we want it moving as quickly as possible.
Lindsay Miller is a staff attorney with the ACLU of Illinois, joining us to talk more about their lawsuit against the Illinois Department of Corrections. Lindsay, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.
I find it incredibly difficult to just talk about racial subjects with black people.
What are you afraid of?
My fear in communicating might be that my prejudice would be revealed.
That's part of the film Racial Taboo. That voice you just heard is the film's director, Brian Grimm, explaining how he felt in 2008 when he says it was difficult for him to talk about race, especially with black people. Right now, he's on the line with us from his home in North Carolina. Brian, welcome to The 21st. Thanks so much for being with me.
Hey, it's nice to meet you, Nyla. Thanks for having me on The 21st.
Can you take us back to 2008? What made you want to create this film?
You know, I didn't want to create a film. I wasn't a filmmaker. I was just some guy that had retired and didn't have a real plan until one day I saw a couple news items on TV that black people have historically had double the unemployment of white people and that 25% of black people were living in poverty. And I just did not understand that. And of course, I was a conservative Republican, and so I said, these people, they just need to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. But on the other side, I said, I need to think about this more critically. What data do I have that drives my opinions? And the answer was none. So I spent the next year and a half going around to seven states to talk to 150 people, and I came to one profound conclusion, that everything that I thought I knew about black people was taught to me by someone white. So I learned a lot of things. Black folks have a lot of headwinds. Like one of them is a white felon can get a job easier than a black man without a felony conviction. And so the things that I learned, it was interesting, and I thought other people would be interested in seeing it. And I knew that the way things were being done with race were not being done in a non-shaming way. So we decided to combine accurate history, psychology, and stand-up comedy in a film that makes this very accessible for everyone so that it comes from a place of love and just having a good time.
And obviously this is, as you said, you package this in a way that you feel like brings everybody to the table. And I think because part of that is this can be a really, it often is a very difficult conversation for people to have. And that's actually something that you talk about in the movie. I wonder if we can listen to a part of that.
Sure.
We develop our views of people based on what we learned as children, from our friends, and what we see in the media. I used to think of all black people as being very similar. However, they are not, and making assumptions like that made me look a little foolish more than once.
We're as diverse as anybody. There's not the acceptable black person, you see. So these kinds of statements create distrust.
It's a little bit from the film. Brian, when you hear that, I think for people who are white probably have very different reactions than people who are black when they listen to that. And I wonder for you, when you first started these conversations, what were you afraid of when you were doing this? What was the thing that you thought was going to be the most difficult about this?
Well, to be honest with you, I didn't know what I was afraid of, but man, I was scared. I thought the earth was going to open up and swallow me or something. And the irony is, the first time that I admitted that I was prejudiced to a black man, he was like, oh, okay, that's cool. And because it's like, he already knew or suspected that, black folks have had 200, 300, 400 years of opportunity to hone their prejudice radar. So, and we as white people, we're sort of oblivious to the black experience for the most part. And so we do things that are not necessarily what we intend, but people are so interested in not being shamed that we kind of go overboard sometimes.
Last month, we had a conversation with a woman. Her name is Fern Chappell. She's an African-American woman from Carbondale. She, along with an interracial group, was watching the film. Let's hear a little bit of what Fern had to say.
As a black culture, we've had films like this for years, hundreds and hundreds of films. But I think a lot of times because it was produced by a black person, they're like, oh, they're just sour grape. That doesn't happen anymore. But because this film was produced by a white person presenting the same information these other films in the past have presented, it's like, oh, wow, maybe this is really going on.
So, Brian, when you created this film, was the intention that it would be interracial groups that would be watching this film together?
When we started about 10 years ago, we really didn't have a vision for the film. I just thought I would put it out there initially. And the first thing I learned was I had 500 DVDs made. I was just going to sell it as a regular DVD. And what I learned was that black people would take it and watch it by themselves, and white people would take it and watch it by themselves. And no dialogue or no relationships were formed. And you have to form a relationship to overcome your fear response. So we said, okay, the only way you can see this film is when people in communities come together and preferably, and very strongly preferably, continue the conversation. And in many towns, they have continued the conversation every week for years now. And as it turns out, it doesn't take a lot of people in a community to change the community's culture.
And when you talk about that culture, one of the things you focus on in the movie is the psychology sort of behind race relations and communities. You know, you've talked a lot about this, right? The associations we have, they're based on our experiences. And I wanted to play another cut for the film that particularly has to do with police, which is obviously a big part of our national conversation we're having now around race and policing. Let's hear a little bit of that.
The way that black people are depicted on the nightly news every day makes white people afraid.
Every time you turn on the news, it's someone's getting arrested, someone's getting murdered, and I can see how easily that position can get skewed. So I'm thinking a lot of times that, okay, is that how you're going to see me?
So what are your first thoughts when you see the police?
So you hear you asked that last question. What are your first thoughts when you see the police to a group of young black students, of teenagers? Can you describe their reaction? It sounds like there was just silence there in the film.
Well, yeah, the setup for that is I'm a tall, white, bald male that looks like the poster boy for the KKK in front of these young black males. And that's uncomfortable in and of itself. But now we're asking this group of kids to respond on a subject that is just kind of uncomfortable for them to say anything because they're respectful kids. So, and I think that's part of it. And I think the other part of it is their experience is very different in many cases. So I think that was the primary response, just a little bit of apprehension in the environment.
Well, and I think that's a tough thing, right? How do we get to understand other people's experiences? How do you sort of hope to use the film as a launching off point to show that, you know, as you said, it sounds like you've gone through a journey yourself where you're very conscious of just who you are and how that appears to other people.
Yeah, I have gone through a journey, but that doesn't put me in a situation where I don't do dumb stuff. You know, I still do it. But the difference is not that I don't do it. It's that I'm aware after the fact that I can critically evaluate it. Hey, I'm 61 years old. I've been, you know, subject to media for a long time. You know, TV, broadcast TV portrays, you know, if it bleeds, it leads philosophy. And so the negativity is rampant in the media. So that's kind of creates perception. People may have grown up a certain way. That creates perception. And the problem is, at least from a biological perspective, unless we have positive experiences, those negative experiences and those negative impressions have been what has kept us alive for tens of thousands of years. And that's difficult to overcome. And the only way to overcome it is to develop a personal connection with someone that is different from you.
Is it frustrating that to you, I wonder how it is to you personally, as you've done all this work, sounds like you've reached out and you've tried to really have meaningful relationships with people who are different from you. Is it frustrating that you sometimes feel like you still have prejudices?
No, I think I'm pretty, forgiving of myself. And I think that's one of the messages that I would share with white people particularly, is be forgiving of yourself. One of the problems that we white males have is the V word. We don't do V very well, and that's vulnerability. And if we can be a little more vulnerable and accept that, hey, this is okay, because if you're talking to a black person and you own it, they, will instantly say, oh, that's cool. I think we're afraid to do that, and as a result, we don't have meaningful conversations. I mean, white people like to intellectualize on this subject, but I remember the first time I ever admitted that I was prejudiced. It was to a black male in Oxford, North Carolina. And I was in a Toyota Corolla, and we're driving up to an old Jim Crow theater for a location to film Eddie McCoy, who's in the film. And I was kind of excited to get out of the car, and Eddie gently grabbed my arm. Now, Eddie's all street. He's a big dude in this tiny car, and I'm a pretty big guy. And I'm just kind of wanting to get up there, and he gently grabs my arm, and he says, Brian, I got a question for you. And I'm thinking to myself, I can answer any question. I've been studying this stuff for years now. But he didn't want to ask me an intellectual question. He wanted to ask me a personal question. He said, are you prejudiced? I went to that place that all us white people go, I've got a black friend, I don't see color, I don't have a prejudice bone in my body. But I felt I really needed to own it. And I was scared to say this to this guy. And I looked at him real sheepishly and I said, I am prejudiced. He goes, yeah, me too. Let's go up to the theater and take a look. So by owning that, we are still friends today. And I think people really need to just try that, experiment with that one or two times. And that's the beauty of these racial taboo events, where we always try to have conversations afterwards, because we're not attracting activists. We're not attracting people. We're just attracting really nice people very often at churches, community centers. And so it really is a safe environment to build community.
And one of the things you're doing is you're actually working on an initiative in Springfield that involves the police and the community. Can you tell me more about that?
Sure. We're very fortunate in that several police departments have embraced this because of it's non-threatening. But in the city of Springfield, the mayor has an initiative. Every single police officer has gone through this with community members. And then they are now embracing it for every single one of the 1,200 city employees.
Wow. So that's in Springfield. I want to thank Brian Grimm. He's been telling us about his film, Racial Taboo, about the different screenings that have been happening. Brian, thanks for being with me.
Thank you, Mom.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This is a special rebroadcast of a previous episode. When University of Illinois professor Mark Hertzman began his History of Black Music course, PhD student Marcelo Cuyujian had an idea. Why not integrate local high school students and have them participate in a jazz concert? The high school students worked alongside Marcelo and college students from the Black Music course to prepare for a Central High School Jazz Fest. Our intern, Abar Alhiti, went to the concert and brought us back this story.
Marcelo Cuyumje is getting his PhD in musical arts at the University of Illinois. He teamed up with history professor Mark Hertzman to go beyond the classroom for a course on the history of black music.
I had this idea of trying to do a project with high school students. It's important for us to support the music teachers here in this area, especially trying to give them, the students, a little bit more of a broader view of music.
Instead of just talking about the music, the idea was to get out into the community and share the music with the younger generation.
Lily Bani Hashem, I go to Uni High, and I play piano.
I'm Donovan Paris, and I go to Urbana High School, and I play the drums.
Lily and Donovan were two of the 10 high school students who performed. Lily, who's a student at Urbana University High, said learning to play jazz piano was a new experience.
I had never played jazz piano before. I had no idea how to do it, so I think I learned a lot about jazz and its history, so that was good.
After a few weeks of practice, high school students from 5 different Champaign-Urbana area schools played selections studied in the class.
Jazz is the foundation of all the music. I mean, every genre of music, most of them came from jazz.
Jonathan Foster is a University of Illinois sophomore studying civil engineering. He helped teach the students to prepare them for their performance.
I didn't always listen to jazz. The only reason I listened to jazz was because I played jazz in high school. And when I played jazz in high school, I was very sad that it was a very contained sort of event. Like, we just stayed in the classroom, we played jazz, we left, we performed. So I really enjoyed an opportunity to interact with other jazz musicians and learn more about what you can do as a jazz musician.
Hertzman says they hope to expand the collaboration with high school students in the future.
I mean, the fact that Marcel has been able to bring in these high school students who have, like, gotten these amazing lectures, had discussions, and now are going to be culminating in this concert, that itself is awesome.
A few voices and music from last Friday's performance. Thanks to Abral Akiti for bringing us that sound. We just heard from Marcelo, the graduate student who teamed up with University of Illinois professor Mark Hertzman to make that performance happen. Both of them are in studio with me now. Marcelo, Mark, thanks for being here. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
So, Marcelo, you can hear in the tape how enthusiastic the students seem to be. Were you surprised by how they responded? Is this what your intention was?
Yeah, a little bit. I knew they were all involved with music, so I was expecting that, but they all were really great. They were really excited about having the chance to play a little bit more. So that was something a little bit of a surprise for me.
Yeah, Mark, was it when you when this whole idea came about? I don't know what you thought would happen, but I'm wondering sort of what your thoughts were.
The concert was amazing. I was just blown away. Marcelo always does amazing things, but it was remarkable to see the students come together and play such an amazing set. So it was fantastic. You know, I had high expectations, exceeded them.
Yeah, Mark, why did you start this History of Black Music course?
So the course itself, I've taught a version of it. It's the first course I ever taught after grad school. I have a longstanding history in music and race and how the idea of black music came to be. Here, the main intention was kind of within the history department to have a course that shows that history is not, I mean, most of our courses show that history isn't just reciting names, dates, and memorization, that it's really a way to engage with the current world and to understand it in context.
Yeah. Marcelo, for you, how did you first hear? Did you take the course? How did you first come up with the idea?
Mark is a co-advisor of my wife. She's a PhD student in history program. And I knew he had done research on Brazilian music, so we've been in touch for a while. He's now helping me out with my own research project. And then when I heard that he was going to teach that class, I had some interest in doing some kind of a collaboration with professors here on campus. And then I thought that would be a good opportunity to do that.
Right, right. And what did you think in terms of the high school students that you thought that you would approach? Why did you think high school students in particular?
Well, I just always felt that there was a need of for our campus community to reach out to high school students. I just think our jazz program here has such a great structure in terms of great faculty, some very, very talented undergraduate and graduate students. And I really thought that high school students could benefit a lot from being in contact with us. I have a few private students that I teach piano lessons, and I noticed they were not having as many opportunities to perform. So that was the thing. And then when Mark told me about that class, I thought that would be a good way also to to give them a little bit of an historical context that they're not having their school ensembles as well. So those are two things that we're trying to accomplish that way.
What are you doing your PhD in?
It's actually called a DMA because it's a performance, it's doctorate performance in jazz studies, and I'm a piano player.
Uh-huh, and you're a piano player. Yeah. How did you first get it? When did you first hear about jazz? What was your first experience with jazz?
It was with a friend in school. In Brazil, we don't have school in music like in here. So I had a friend who was playing trumpet, and he started getting interested in it. My uncle is actually a jazz drummer. He was living in São Paulo at the time, an hour away. And when I told him, oh, I have a friend who's trying to teach me this, like, can you give me some pointers? And then he started bringing me almost every holidays I would spend with him at his home. And we would go to listen to some music I heard him playing. So that's kind of how I got involved into it.
And Mark, how about you? You said you've been teaching this course you've been teaching not just jazz, this is a history of black music, right? So this goes back, I don't even know how does that start?
How does it start? It's a long story, but my research originally, my first book was about the history of samba music in Brazil. And so this goes back to grad school. My interest, obviously, in music goes back, much further, to when I was young. Yeah, so there's sort of a long history. One of the neat things that I think we try to do in the course at the beginning is try to get students to think about where their own interests come from and sort of what are the pathways through which they get to like the music they like. And I find in these conversations, it's almost always parents and school is sort of some of the first ways, and not just radio and internet, but
right, people, but their families, like, and having
exactly.
the music right. And
exactly.
So I guess for both of you, did you think this was a good opportunity? It was interesting to listen to the students, Donovan and Lily, two of the high school students who I guess felt like they kind of knew about jazz, but obviously were more. And I know some of this didn't end up on air. I heard some other tape talking. They talked about, how much they loved hip hop and all of these other things and didn't really understand sort of the influence of, for example, jazz and all of that. Mm-hmm. Marcelo, was that a big part of what you wanted to teach them as well?
Yeah.
Sort of experience or have them experience?
Yeah. So I think one of the main issues we have with jazz education today is that it's becoming almost like a sort of museum music where you just learn about it from the past, but you can't really connect it to the present. And hearing that he was teaching that course, I thought it was a good opportunity to show them the connections with hip-hop, which is a music that a lot of people listen to today, and then also connecting that to funk, soul, and R&B, to show kind of the lineage. And in schools today here in the United States, and especially here in Champaign, most people have contact in terms of popular music with jazz, but not so much hip-hop. So one of the professors who came to talk, Adam Cruz, his whole project is about trying to develop programs of hip-hop in public schools. So the idea is, how can you take this music that you're learning in school and connect it with the music that you actually like to listen to? And I think that was one of the goals we were able to accomplish.
Yeah, Mark, did you find that with the college students as well? That's part of what you're trying to do with the course too?
Yeah, absolutely. And I have to say that one of the posters for the course has a picture of hip-hop. Has a picture of Jay-Z with performing with the Roots. And as you get into the course, I think a lot of people take the course. They want to have Jay-Z and they want to have hip hop, and we do a lot of that. But the course also really tries to open them to not just sort of precursors in the U.S., but we do music in Brazil and Cuba and Japan and in different parts of Africa. Hip hop in some ways is kind of a hook that then gets them into a deeper history.
I mean, is that a tough thing to do when you're doing music education? I'm just thinking about what Marcelo said about, we kind of think about, whenever you say history of music, I think you do think it's sort of like a museum. You do kind of put music into a historical context as opposed to thinking about what's happening now, the music that's being played now, all of those influences. How hard is it to do that in a course?
Yeah, I think it's actually that aspect coming from a historian is in some ways easier because, kids really want to learn about, they're interested in the material. So one of the things that I know was important for Marcelo and myself was to put Black Lives Matter at sort of the center of this and to really have it be important. And, the students, this is one of the most engaged.
Yeah, how did you do that?
Yeah, so.
When you think about music of Black Lives Matter, of course, I'm thinking about like Janelle Monáe and different, but what particularly how did you do that?
Right, so two ways, I guess, in particular. I mean, one is we've tried throughout the semester to think about the civil rights movement and sort of other historical precedences in connection to, but also in differences between what we're doing today and what we see today and then. And then also, we've actually focused on. So this week, for example, we talked about in class Colin Kaepernick and the anthem. We've done a lot of discussions of and the Black national anthem and sort of performances around the anthem and national identity and racism. Yesterday, we were visited by the local hip-hop duo, which is now a trio, Mother Nature, and they are very engaged with Black Lives Matter. So, so we're trying to do it, you know, in a number of ways, both historically and then also just connections to things going on today.
Marcelo, when you talk to the students, I know you were mostly working with them on music, but do you get into kind of these conversations with them about protest and music and how that is influences art these days?
So in this program, we had meetings on Saturdays where the first part of it was a lecture. So we did talk about it a little bit, and then the second part was a rehearsal. The lectures went a little bit longer than I was expecting. Now that's bad, but I was hoping to have some more time while we were playing to discuss those things. Because we had so such long lectures, which I think was actually really great, in the time we were rehearsing, we really needed to focus more on the music. So unfortunately, it was a little more separate than I was hoping for. That's something we might want to.
What kind of things did you lecture? What did you talk about in the lecture?
So we had three lectures. The first one was about sampling in hip hop and how a lot of hip hop artists are sampling from records of soul and R&B and jazz. To show that historic connection, talk about how they're thinking about music and also where they're drawing their ideas from. The second lecture, so that was Professor John Myers from African American Studies. On the second Saturday, we had Adam Cruz from Music Education, and he's talking about his project of why is it that we don't have hip-hop in schools, the concepts of appropriateness of music in public school settings. And his whole research is about, on his doctoral research, he looked at one hip-hop artist who dropped out of school. And his question is, why is it that there's this kid who loves music? He became a professional musician.
A great writer, loves to write, sure.
But in school, he didn't have any success in music and ended up dropping out. And the third lecture was Gabriel Solis from Musicology. And he talked about kind of a history of Black liberation movements. Focusing a little bit more on civil rights and how that connects to jazz that was being made in the 60s. So we did have a lot of...
Now, we heard a little bit of Stevie Wonder. What music did you pick for the students to play?
We played I Wish and Science You Delivered. And the second one, actually, I didn't know. I've been trying to learn more about Stevie, and I have a student, a high school student, who showed me most of those tracks. So Daniel Austin from Judah. So that's been a good exchange that I've been getting from them as well.
Yeah, Mark, what was sort of the goal for you? What were you hoping to have the college students get? It was interesting to hear that engineering student in the audio piece that we heard say, hey, when I was in high school, I didn't really have people I could kind of hang out with and talk about this. So this was cool to do this with high school students now that I'm in college.
Right. Yeah. You know, something happened yesterday sort of in class with the when Mother Nature came that really I thought was great. I mean, part of what we want the students to do is to think historically, obviously, and contextualize. Also to think about how hip hop and different forms of Black music can create limiting narratives. So we've talked a lot about how difficult it is to be a woman in hip hop, how difficult it is to be mixed race and all these kinds of things. But somebody asked that question to one of the to Truth, one of the members, and she identifies as a Black queer woman, and she said, I don't give an F about it. And it was really kind of it was an amazing moment. I think that we've been talking about sort of limitations and all this, and this was really an inspiration. She came from Illinois, came out of the system that these students are in, and is doing something really remarkable despite a lot of challenges.
So this is work. Are you guys going to do this again? Are you going to plan to have have more high school students involved and maybe do some more of these concerts?
Yeah, hopefully.
Yeah, Marcelo always has big plans. He has some big ideas for next year. But yeah, I definitely want to keep this going. It's just great for everyone, I think.
All right. Well, thanks so much for being with me. That's Mark Hertzman is an associate professor. He's also the director of undergraduate studies in the Department of History at the University of Illinois. Marcelo Kujuman, did I say that right? Who's also at the UIC, UIUC in music. Thank you both for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you have Alexa, we're easy to find. Tell her, ask NPR One to play the 21st. All of those links, directions for Alexa, every other way to contact us. If you want to leave us a voicemail, if you'd like to send us an email, if you want to follow us on social media, all of that information is at our website, 21stshow.org. I'm Nyla Boodoo, broadcasting today from the Medill School of Journalism in downtown Chicago. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.